We're in Luke chapter 19, and this is one of the most dramatic prophecies found anywhere in the Bible concerning the fact that the nation of Israel has said thumbs down to the Messiah, and Jesus begins to predict what the results will be. And we stopped just short this morning of the prophetic details of the prophecy, and they begin in chapter 19, verse 43 and 44. And there are six details, six future tense, indicative mood verbs about the fall of Jerusalem. Keep in mind, Luke 19 and verse 41 is an absolute crisis. It is the biggest crisis the nation Israel ever knew in her entire history. And the Lord literally sobs over the city, because as he begins in verse 42 with a second-class condition sentence, saying, if you had known, and you have not. And then, as we pointed out this morning, that the words in this, the day, are underscored in boldface. In this particular day. And this particular day means, I've offered you myself, and you've said no. I have shown you the miracles, and you have not believed. That's it. This is the day. It's all over. And as that day comes, he begins to tell them that you've turned the corner to judgment, and here is what is going to happen. Number one point. These are each of the future tense indicative mood verbs. Number one, the judgment that is coming is certain. The judgment that is coming is certain. And that is found in verse 43, the A part. For the days, notice the future tense, shall come. It's not here yet, but it is certain because it's indicative mood. Shall come up on you. And so, again, the days spoken of are the days of judgment, and they are certain. They shall come upon you, and they are going to be certain. We might add that if we're very generous with time, Jesus made the prediction somewhere around 30 A.D. The fulfillment was in about 70 A.D. So the judgment is certain, and from the historical standpoint, is about 40 years away. About 40 years to go before the prophecy is going to be fulfilled. But it is certain. Reading again, the days shall come upon you when? And that introduces us to the second part of the prophecy, the B part. The day shall come when your enemies will throw up a bank before you. Prophecy number two. The enemy will erect a palisade. The enemy will erect a palisade about the city. First of all, the enemy is whom? Only possible identity of the enemy. The enemy equals Rome. It's the only power on the world scene that in any way could brought about the fulfillment of this prophecy. And when we look at what happened and the way the prophecy was fulfilled, it was done by Rome. So the enemy, that is Imperial Rome, and it will be under the leadership of a man named Titus, is going to play that war. So the enemy will erect a palisade. Second, we should remember that the Jewish / Roman war took place between 66 and 70 A.D. And I know that's A.D. should come first. A.D., 66 through 70. 70 was the final year of it, but there was fighting, there was battle. When we think of the destruction and the by Titus of Jerusalem, don't think of one Monday morning as they awoke, suddenly they look off and here come the Romans. And by Monday evening, the city was sacked by Rome. This went on 66, 67, 68, 69, and into 70. This went on for about 5 years and was terminated in 70 A.D. Now, what do we mean by a palisade? A palisade is essentially a fence. See, a fence. And what it was, you've seen them, it was a fence made of a row of stakes. And the stakes were pushed deep into the ground. And what about the upper peak of the stakes of a palisade? What's it look like? They were sharpened to a point. So that you had built around the city, if it was a normal one, it would be a fence made up of stakes that were deep in the ground, and they were finished to a point. They were pointed. The word also can be used to include an embankment. In other words, it can be the stakes that are sharpened. It can also refer to an embankment, which would be a dirt wall around the city. The purpose of that would be this. If you were in the city and could get up on the walls of the city, and you saw the enemy marching toward you, who has the advantage? You've got the advantage because you're on the wall, you look down on them, and you can attack the enemy from a distance. So that is not the way the enemy attack. The enemy attack by saying, let's simply make the pulpit here, the city of Jerusalem. And it's walled, and I can stand here and watch, guard over the walls. However, their method was to begin by building a wall around the wall. And that had several purposes, one of which was what? If they build a wall around the wall and fortify it, what limitation is this going to put on the city dwellers? You can't get out. And if you can't get out, where are you going to get your food supplies? And they couldn't. And one of the great disasters of the siege of Jerusalem by Titus was not so much the killing with the sword. They just sealed off the city. And the people starved to death. So this was, again, to prepare protection and getting ready for an attack. Preparation of the palisade. Second, future indicative verb, verse 43, the day shall come when your enemies will throw up a bank before you and surround you and hem you in. And so really number 3 and 4 are very similar, because they involve the complete encirclement of the city, and they will hem you in. So there is no ingress or egress into the city except through them. The Romans did this so thoroughly, and with the records we've got, they in this Jewish war, 66 to 70, they did this primarily in the closing 5 months. And in the closing 5 months, they so surrounded the city, there was no way out. You couldn't get into it, you couldn't get out of it, and as a result, literally thousands died of starvation. There were no food resources, and we'll read from Josephus' history in a few minutes some of the results of that. So they were surrounded in, and as a result, famine killed most. We have experienced that on a pitifully limited type thing. You know, we hear that there's going to be a snowstorm, 10 inches of snow tonight, and you go out and you get to the grocery store and buy things so that you'll have something in if you can't get out. Well, that's quite limited, because you can probably do without the Hi-Hos and the Cheetos and so forth that you bought for this mighty food reserve. But nonetheless, that's that kind of... If you can imagine... Well, let's put it this way. Suppose you were surrounded, your home was surrounded for 5 months. You couldn't get out. How many would starve to death? Well, I think most people, unless you happen to have in your garage 5 months' food supply, which probably is not all that bad idea, but by and large, most people would starve. I mean, 2 days on milk,
and you have to, I mean, there's always milk there, but you don't drink it because it's spoiled. And so you probably every two or three, a standard call at nighttime, what is it? When you come home, bring two items, bread and milk. And that's because of the notoriously bad planning and preparation practiced by the housewife in America. And now we have a theme for a whole sermon. I wouldn't dare. So as a result of this being surrounded and hemmed in, you had massive starvation. Fifth, in verse 4, they will level you to the ground and your children within you. Now, what does it mean that the enemy is going to level you? And that is a key word. What does it mean they will level you and your children? And the word that is translated for level is a Greek word, edaphidso, and it bears two meanings with it. And it's used throughout Greek literature in alternately between these two things. Number one, it can be used of a city. And as such, it means raise, R-A-Z-E, to the ground. And therefore, if you take the word edaphidso, you can demonstrate that in many cases, someone comes in and they bulldoze the city, they burn it, they loot it, they raise it to the ground. We saw edaphidso in, I don't think anybody used that word on the networks, but we saw edaphidso in Los Angeles. Just literally looting and tearing the thing to the ground. It can also be used of people. And when it is used of people, it means dash to the ground. It's found used, for examples, in context where the Romans or others would come in and an invasion, and we know it meant dash to the ground because it was the word used when a Roman soldier would take a baby and, as a football player might do, he spiked the ball and they would spike the babies. And the word edaphidso was used for literally dashing a body into the ground in order to kill. And so you say, well, which idea? Both. The city was raised. The people were literally dashed to the ground. Our word for it would be bloodbath. A literal bloodbath for Jerusalem is what is predicted. In 44, you have the last future indicative, or the sixth one. And the sixth one said, the enemy will demolish you. They will not leave in you one stone upon another. And so all of that is pictured, the demolishing. And the demolishing, or not leaving one stone upon another, image obviously has to do with the city. And therefore, if you visit Jerusalem today, the only thing you can see that is left is the only single remains, and the only single remains is the Wailing Wall. And if you've ever seen the Wailing Wall, it is truly magnificent. Let's see. I would put the stones in the Wailing Wall that were the temple of the foundation, oh, probably half the size of this. Some of you that have seen it with me, I know they're large. Is that fair? Say from here up and over to the wall, probably half the size? Maybe bigger than that. Maybe enough to take in. It just eludes me. Because when you see it, it's such a fascinating thing to watch the Jewish people. And the thing you're attracted to is not the wall. The thing you're attracted to is the little pieces of paper containing prayers that are folded up and they're stuck on the wall. And the wall is literally mortared with Jewish prayers that are stuck in the wall of the soldiers and so forth. And that's it. That's all that's left. You can imagine how the Romans might tend to overlook a stone that size. and figure we've done enough to level the city. But that is it. And when you go to Jerusalem, even though you see many things like the temple, and you see buildings and so forth, you need to think fundamentally there was nothing left of this city by the Roman conquerors led by Titus in 70 AD except what you're looking at right there at the Wailing Wall. That is it. Now, as we said, they have excavated down to different layers so that the Pool of Siloam, you can probably look down about 20 feet, and you can see it down there below, and that's probably a valid archaeological spot in Palestine. But as far as the Jerusalem in which Jesus lived, it is gone, except for many of those lower levels. And of course, over the centuries, there's been more destruction. And so you can probably get to the level of it, but basically the only thing that was really left is the Wailing Wall, which is the final part of it. When the Romans won after a five-month final struggle, they still, and again you have historical record, they still hated the Jews so much that the only one they preserved would be a few that escaped that were good-looking, and they were kept to meet their death in the gladiatorial rings. And they were used basically as quote-unquote sports bait in their contest. Now, a few observations before I read a little more from Josephus. And these are simply observations going back on the whole passage, beginning at verse 40. And then I'll give you some more illustrations of it. In verse 40, when he approached, he saw the city and wept over it. And let me mark this down because it is important. Beware of any view of God that deprives him of emotion. Beware of any view of God that deprives him of emotion. And let me show you one of the technical ways that we do that. If I would say, for example, that God has eyes and God has ears, we don't mean that he has literal ears and literal eyes. We mean that that's the human feature that God has in abundance. If we can hear, God can hear everything. Therefore, God has ears. If we can see a few things, God can see everything. Therefore, God has eyes. And we give you always a long word for that. And what is it? Anthropomorphism. Anthropomorphism simply means that we take human characteristics and we apply them to God. And that's very valid. I don't think anyone would take that because the ear of the Lord hears such and such that God has ears as we do. When we take the same thing and apply it to emotion, God made Adam and he repented that he had done so, or man that and repented that he had done so, or any of feelings applied to God, we have another nice word that we apply to us, to that, and we say it is an anthropopathism, which means attributing human emotion to God. Now, what I'm saying is this. Don't so anthropopathemism everything that you have a view of God who doesn't feel anything. Can you think of another way that can be perverted? God is so great, he's so awesome, that he doesn't feel what we feel. That's not biblical. And we're going to look at some passages that if they do not express the deepest, fullest emotion on the part of God, I don't know how you could ever say it. God feels. Let's keep that in mind. God feels. So much so that, and we'll finish up the commentary on Ephesians, so much so that when you look at the mightiness and the power and the sovereignty of God, that you just stand there and are amazed when Paul says, don't pain the Holy Spirit. You stop and think for just a moment that we, the creature can pain God? And that's over against the view that, I mean, who am I that I could pain God? We can. And it is the teaching there that the individual believer may pain or grieve, to use the word there, the Holy Spirit. And let's look at a few of the God feels passages. Hosea 11. Hosea 11. And I'm turning to three of my favorite God feels passages. And we shouldn't miss this. God is the awesome ruler of the universe, but he also feels. This, by the way, is where Christianity flies off and leaves every other religion in the world. You cannot come up with a religion where there is a God that loves so much man that he seeks him in order to save him by grace. You would challenge Hinduism and everything else that is. Where can you have a religion where God is so personal and loves man so much that he seeks him and says, I desire to save you in grace? And you can survey the religions of the world and you come up empty-handed with any such thing. Hosea 11, verse 8. And if you can read this without any feeling, then you must be dead. Because God looks at rebellious Israel. And what does he say? How can I give you up, O Ephraim? How can I surrender you, O Israel? How can I make you like Admah? And these were two places of great judgment. How can I make you like Admah? How can I treat you like Zebulun? My heart is turned over within me, and my compassions are kindled. Does God feel? And if you wanted to say that God felt, would you try to say it with more poignancy and power than what you've got there? Micah. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah. Micah chapter 7. If you get in situations in life where you just need someone to feel with you, may I make a very simple suggestion? You might try God, because he does feel. Micah chapter 7 and verse 18. Again, another beautiful expression. Who is a God like you? And he's simply saying, compare God to all the gods of the ancient world. Who's God like you who pardons iniquity, passes over the rebellious act of the remnant of his possession? He does not retain his anger forever because he delights in unchanging love. Tell me God does not feel. And if God does not feel, how do we explain this verse? And finally, our last one in Zephaniah. Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk. And then following Habakkuk, Nahum, and Zephaniah. Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 17. The Lord your God is in your midst, a victorious warrior, your warrior, and he will exult over you with joy. Does God feel? He will exult over you with joy. He will be quiet in his love. He will rejoice over you with shouts of joy. Does God feel? And all of those, I think, are important. And therefore, when we come to Luke chapter 11 and 9 and verse 41, and Jesus weeps, he's simply expressing a very important point. God feels. Beware of any view of God that deprives him of emotions. Second observation, the words, if you had known, the words, if you had known, should impress us with the importance of using present opportunities. It should impress the importance of today's opportunity. And as the door on God's grace to them closes, and as his forbearance and long-suffering runs out, he goes back and says, if, when you saw Lazarus raised from the dead, if you had known who I was, if you'd seen the feeding of the 5,000, and you guys saw it, didn't you? If you had known all of these endless opportunities, if you'd only taken just one, none of this would have happened. Notice how the prophecy ends in verse 44. All of this happens. He begins by saying why it's happened. If you had known second class and you did not. And it ends by saying because you did not recognize the time of your visitation or the time of God's grace. Is there anything that ought to enforce more emphatically in our minds the importance of the opportunities of Sunday, June 7th, 6:37 p.m. in the evening? And that is vital to recognize those things. Now, may I say on number two, I wasted my breath. Really? Because nobody does this. Isn't it the history of Scripture that man goes resisting up until the final day, and when the door of the ark slams shut, he says, oh, let me in. And it's too late. And therefore, these are important words. Unfortunately, they're not heeded by many, but number one, they're important. Okay, third. Notice coming down to the end of the verse, it's because you did not recognize the time of your visitation. Time of your visitation was the special opportunity of grace. And that makes the third observation. The nearer grace is, the nearer judgment is if we neglect the grace. The nearer is judgment if we neglect grace. Sometimes we miss that because, and again, to illustrate it visually, if I can, put us over here. And when God moves toward us in grace, something is attached right behind grace. It's called judgment. That if grace is way out here, so is judgment. But as grace moves near in toward man, on his heels is grace, is judgment. And that's the context here. You have been visited with the very Son of God. And now that you've rejected him, grace steps aside and judgment rules the day. Four. And this is coming off of chapter 19 and verse 42. Jesus says, if you had known this day, even you, the things which make for peace, but now they've been hidden from your eyes. Notice the blindness. Out of Proverbs, what comes before a fall? Remember that, had that verse shot at you? What comes before a fall? Pride comes before a fall. Let's take that thing and modify it to fit right here. Notice right here, if pride comes before a fall, then blindness comes before judgment. Or blindness is prelude to judgment. And I think the best way, perhaps, to illustrate that, and I don't know whether this is true. I've been told that it is. So, assuming it to be the case. If you take a frog and try to drop him in very hot water, he won't stay. But there is a way to boil a live frog, so I'm told. Put the pot in with cold water and put the frog into the cold water and warm it. And as you warm it, he becomes more comfortable. And pretty soon, so I hear, you have boiled frog. And that well illustrates what happens here. Opportunity opportunity, and the grace is running out, and the judgment is closer, and the pot is getting hotter. And then suddenly, we're boiled and didn't feel a thing. Now let me read a little more to you from Josephus. If you were not here this morning, this book, Josephus, the book was published in about 93 A.D. So it's one of your very dependable works of history, recording what happened in various areas. In the Wars of the Jews, I'm looking at Book 5, Chapter 12, and the title given by those that edited Josephus is Titus thought it fit to encompass the city round about with a wall. That's what the Lord said. After which the famine consumed the people by whole houses and families together. And that's simply what we commented on. They were all sealed in. They couldn't get out. So they starved to death. And let's see. How far did we read? Oh, here's another interesting way they would torture the people. We read this morning, did we not, that Titus went outside and things got so bad, he threw up his hands toward God and said, I had nothing to do with this, so let me read that little section and move on with a little more in it. However, when Titus, in going his rounds along the valleys, saw them full of dead bodies, and the thick putrefaction running about them, he gave a groan, and spreading out his hands to heaven, called God to witness that this was not his doing. And such was the sad case of the city itself. But the Romans in general were very joyful, since none of the seditious all the way through Josephus' writings in this context, the seditious refers to the Jews. They were accused of rebelling against Rome. So the seditious, end quote, that is the Jews, could now make sallies out of the city, because they were themselves disconsolate, and the famine already touched them also. The Roman beside had great plenty of corn and other necessities out of Syria and out of the neighboring provinces, many of whom would stand near the wall of the city and show the people what great quantities of provisions they had, and so to make the enemy more sensible to their famine by the great plenty, even to satiety, which they themselves had. And if you can imagine the torture of starving people, and the Roman soldier orders a banquet, and he says, look, starving people, and he eats in front of them. And you can imagine the torture that would be. And we can't even illustrate it. This week we went on a really dumb kick. Whole wheat pita bread, cucumbers and tomatoes and alfalfa sprouts and bean sprouts and didn't Jane come tonight? Did I hurt her feelings? Anyway, and I'm embarrassed. I go over here to, is it Food Barn at Antioch? Food Barn or Food Chopper? Food Chopper? That's Price Chopper. Whatever they are. And I was coming out with those things feeling so good. Went out the express lane, and right behind the express lane, what is set up? This barbecue. Holy sausage. Smell just drive you nuts. And I went out the door proud. I made it. I didn't buy any greasy poli sausage. But it was there in front of my nose, and I was almost offended. How dare you do that to me? Trying to get out of here, and you put this in front of me. Hey, suppose I was starving to death. That's part of what was happened in the city. Another little section. Here's a description of some of the carnage. It says, indeed, the multitude of carcasses that lay in heaps one on another was a horrible sight and produced a pestilential stench, which was a hindrance to those that would make sallies out of the city and fight the enemy. For those who went into battle had already witnessed 10,000 murders, had to tread upon those dead bodies as they marched along. In other words, there was no way out of the city without walking over putrefying bodies. It talks about if you'd seen Jerusalem before this. Remember when Jesus came down from the Mount of Olives, he saw the beautiful city and the people commented on it. It says, no foreigner that had formerly seen Judea and the most beautiful suburbs of the cities now saw it as a desert, could but lament and mourn sadly at so great a change. For the war had laid all signs of beauty aside and waste. Nor, if anyone had known the place before, would know it now. And so it says, literally, at least in his account, that had you been to Jerusalem, you would have said, where are we? I don't recognize the city. Here's a little section, and I'll make it my last. Josephus says, and indeed, why do I relate these calamities? While Manius, the son of Lazarus, came running to Titus at this very time and told him what had happened. So here is a testimony of one going to Titus from the Roman authorities themselves and reporting what had happened. And he reported to him that there had been carried out through the gate, which was entrusted to his care by the Romans, no fewer than 115,888 dead bodies. That's carnage. In the interval between the 14th day of the month Nisan, when the Romans pitched their camp by the city, and the first day of the month Tammuz, this was itself a prodigious multitude. And though the man was not himself set as governor at that gate, yet he appointed to pay the public stipend for carrying these bodies out, and was so obliged of necessity to number them, while the rest were buried by their relations, though all their burial was but this, to bring them away and cast them out of the city. After this man, there ran away to Titus many of the eminent citizens, and told him the entire number of the poor that were dead was no fewer than 600,000, being thrown out the gates, though still the number of the rest could not be discovered. They told him farther that when they were no longer able to carry out the dead bodies of the poor, they laid their corpse in heaps in very large houses and shut them up therein. Also that Medimnus is a very tiny measure of wheat. A medimnus of wheat was sold for a talent, and that when, a while afterwards, it was not possible to gather herbs, catch this, it was not possible to gather herbs for food in the city. By reason, the city was all walled about. Some persons were driven to that terrible distress as to search the common sewers and old dung hills of cattle and eat the dung which they got there, and what of old they could not endure so much as to see, they now used for food. And that is part of the horrible destruction that came on the city of Jerusalem. And why did it come about? Because grace did not appear? No. But because grace did appear. And it was thumbs down on grace, and it was rejected and turned aside. Now, we do not have time really to launch into the next place, but let's move now and get set up for next time, which we'll do on Wednesday evening. No, we won't. Dave Hunt will be here Wednesday evening, which we'll do next Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. After this prophecy, the Lord then enters the temple. And as he enters the temple in verse 45, and this is sometime now on Monday, as he enters the temple, he begins to cast out those who were selling. And so he moves into the place that is about to be destroyed, and we'll have a diagram of it and what was there and what was meant by all of this. The Lord enters the temple. He throws out the money changers and he begins to teach. And that teaching will be in the temple through all of 20, all of 21, into 22, down through verse 6, where Judas is now set up and paid to betray the Lord. But he teaches in the temple in all of this particular section. And as he comes in to verse 47 of chapter 19, it says he was teaching daily in the temple. And that sets up the next 3 or 4 days of what he was doing. And as he has cast out the money changers, as these called it a den of robbers, the only reason he was not arrested is because the Jewish authorities were afraid of the people. And they're going to have to work it around so they can do it. Now, can you imagine one of the things would naturally come up about Jesus casting out these things in the temple and literally upruling the current religious setting of the Jews, what question might they have? Is there anything they might want to ask Jesus? Who in the world gave you authority to do this? And notice the neat lead-in from the casting out of those that were misusing the temple to chapter 20, verses 1 and 2, and I'll read it and close with it. Came about that on one of those days, namely Monday morning, or sometime Monday, while he was teaching the people in the temple and preaching the gospel, the chief priests and the scribes and the elders confronted him. I mean, this has been coming since last night. They confronted him and spoke to him, saying, "Tell us by what authority you're doing these things, or is who is the one who gave you the authority?" And therefore, you have a neat transition, do you not, into the subject you'd expect next, which is, what is your authority? And we will pick that up in our next study. Father, we thank you once again for this prophecy made so accurately and so fully, fulfilled in such a literal manner. May it stand as a reminder to all of us to whom grace has been extended, to all of those that have had the same kind of visitation that Israel had, the opportunity to know yourself, the opportunity to learn your word, to absorb it, to believe it. May we recognize it is not forever, and may we thus utilize the opportunity and seize it now. In Christ's name.